This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, May 6, 2010. In New York, I'm Doran Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, as the Senate plans hearings for BP executives, we'll look at the legal issues surrounding the explosion that caused the massive oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. In D.C., the FCC releases details to regulate broadband, and lawmakers announce a bill to strip citizenship from those accused of terrorism. And we'll go to Argentina as the country gets a step closer to legalizing same-sex marriage. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Voting has begun in the general election in Great Britain. As well as picking parliament members, voters will elect councillors in 164 local authorities across England. The Labour Party, led by Prime Minister Gordon Brown, has been expected to lose power after 13 years in government. But as FSRN's George Lavender reports, recent polls have raised the possibility that no party will win an overall majority.
Public confidence in politicians has fallen after a series of corruption scandals implicating all three of the main political parties. Documents showed MPs from Labour, the Conservative and Liberal Democrat parties were falsifying expenses claims. Economic issues have dominated this election campaign. While economists claim Britain is no longer in recession, unemployment continues to rise with 2.5 million people currently out of work in Britain. Whichever party wins, public spending is expected to be cut. On the eve of the election, the European Commission warned that the British budget deficit would rise this year to become the largest in the European Union, overtaking even Greece. All three of the main political parties support cuts to public spending. Cuts are feared in health, education and welfare, but a $6.3 billion prison building scheme is likely to remain. First results are expected soon after polls close tonight. George Lavender, FSRN, London.
Nearly 4 months since the Haitian earthquake, relief efforts continue for more than 1.4 million displaced people around the capital city. With billions of dollars of international aid pouring in, President René Préval is asking the Haitian parliament to extend his mandate by 3 months, until May 2011, but is facing resistance. Ansel Hers has more from Port-au-Prince.
Next to his bright red Chinese-built motorcycle on the side of a dusty road, taxi driver Maxime Kisnel says besides losing his home, life after the earthquake is much the same as before. It's a day-to-day struggle to make enough to survive and feed his family, now living under a tarp.
We need a complete election to change all the parts of the government, because all of these parts should go. It's no good for us at all. We need for someone else who was voted in to bring change, because this situation is no good, and it's not getting better.
But President René Préval has other ideas. He wants to stay in office an extra 3 months if the coming November elections do not take place. Préval's government is part of the Interim Haiti Reconstruction Commission, which directs the spending of some $10 billion pledged by international donors. The Haitian parliament, controlled by Préval's Unity Party, gave Préval emergency powers last month to participate in the commission for 18 months. Opposition lawmakers insist Préval must step down on time, but their minority voting bloc has little chance of defeating the proposal. Meanwhile, Haiti's Provisional Electoral Council lost its headquarters in the earthquake. They are working to organize the elections out of a gym. With thousands still displaced from their neighborhoods and without ID cards, it's not clear if elections will be held on time. Ansel Hers, FSRN, Port-au-Prince.
The only surviving gunman involved in the Mumbai terrorist attacks has been sentenced to death by hanging by an Indian court. In December 2008, Pakistani national Ajmal Kassab and nine others raided several locations in India's financial capital, killing 160 people. The attack and subsequent revelation of the nationality of the gunmen has strained relations further between India and Pakistan. Kassab has the right to appeal. Nigeria's President Umaru Yar'Adua has died after a protracted illness. His deputy, Goodluck Jonathan, who has served as the country's interim leader since February, was officially sworn in this morning as the new permanent president. Sam Olikoya reports from Lagos.
The late Umaru Yar'Adua died at his official residence in the capital, Abuja, on Wednesday night after a long battle with kidney and heart disease. The new president, Mr. Goodluck Jonathan, is from the Christian South of Nigeria, while its predecessor, was from the Muslim North. This change of leadership is likely to create a bitter rivalry between Christian and Muslim regions in election due early next year. There is delicate relationship between Nigeria's Muslims and Christians. Religious clashes have claimed more than 10,000 lives in the last 10 years. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. Oil from the spill in the Gulf of Mexico has hit land. Officials are saying a sheen of oil washed onto an uninhabited Louisiana island beach in the Chandelure chain. About a mile from the island chain, the president of St. Bernard Parish is saying that the community does not have enough booms to protect the coast, according to the Times-Picayune. Meanwhile, officials from BP, Halliburton, and Transocean will face lawmakers next week at Senate hearings on the April 20th explosion that caused the ongoing oil spill in the Gulf. A separate Senate hearing will also look into the federal agency that is supposed to oversee oil drilling projects, but exempted BP from preparing a formal response to a blowout scenario like the one that occurred last month. According to Coast Guard estimates, the pace of the spill is set to exceed the Exxon Valdez incident, which spilled 11 million gallons of oil in 1989. To discuss the legal aspects of the issue, we're joined by Robert Weigel. He's an environmental attorney with the Walter Weigel Law Firm in Ocean Springs, Mississippi, and has written about and litigated on issues of ocean policy for many years. Welcome to FSRN.
Well, thank you for having me.
In 2009, BP filed with the Federal Minerals Management Service. They filed an assessment of the Deepwater Horizon well. You've seen this document. Is there anything in there that suggests the company was prepared for this kind of disaster?
You know, that's a really interesting question, because under the laws that govern drilling on the Outer Continental Shelf, companies like BP are supposed to include a blowout scenario, is what it's called, in their exploration plans like this one. And as it turns out, BP did not include such a plan in here because the Minerals Management Service apparently waived that requirement. Now, that's an important thing, because under the regulations that govern those blowout scenarios, that would have given us the exact information that would have helped predict the impacts of a spill like the one we're seeing right now.
And how did not having that assessment contribute to that immediate response in the few days right after the explosion took place?
Well, what the regulations require, and this is really what I think common sense requires as well, is that the company predict what the maximum amount of oil that could be released through a blowout would be, what the likelihood of being able to contain that oil or stop the blowout would be, and how long it would take to drill a relief well, as well as how you would respond or deal with that maximum amount of oil. So if the company and the Minerals Management Service had actually looked at a blowout of the size that we're seeing right now, or even close to the size that we're seeing right now, I think it would have been apparent to everyone that there was no realistic means of controlling the blowout if the valves failed on the well, nor was there any realistic means of controlling the spread of that oil.
I want to play a clip from BP CEO Tony Hayward speaking earlier this week on ABC News, where he makes a distinction about what responsibility the company will take.
This wasn't our accident. This was a drilling rig operated by another company. It was their people, their systems, their processes. We are responsible not for the accident, but we are responsible for the oil and for dealing with it and cleaning the situation up.
So he says BP is responsible for cleanup, but not the explosion. Why make this distinction?
Well, I think that the old aphorism that misery loves company is especially true in legal proceedings. I think what's happening there is BP is saying that Transocean the owner of this drilling rig has responsibility and is going to share the financial responsibility with BP. I think they're saying that the contractors who are working on the rig, like Halliburton, may share responsibility as well. They're really looking, I think, to start introducing the idea that other companies will share liability with them and share what, you know, I think in everyone's estimation is likely to be billions of dollars in damages.
Well, you mentioned Halliburton. Lawsuits filed right after the explosion claim that the cause was when workers from Halliburton improperly capped the well. They were supposed to cement the well. They were working on it before the explosion. The Associated Press points to a 2007 study by the Minerals Management Service that found that cementing was a contributing factor in blowout incidents from 1992 to 2006. What was Halliburton's role in this?
Well, as you said, Halliburton apparently was in charge of the cementing of this well. At this point, I don't think anyone knows exactly what happened there. It's certain that there's going to be an extensive and detailed investigation by the Minerals Management Service, and there certainly will be a lot of outside entities, including Congress and attorneys, who will be going over every detail of what Halliburton did.
And as we said, Halliburton officials will face Senate hearings next week along with BP officials. Robert Weigel, environmental lawyer from Ocean Springs, Mississippi, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Senator Joe Lieberman and congressional co-sponsors introduced legislation today that would strip U.S. citizenship from Americans accused of involvement in terrorist acts. Lieberman cited the alleged attempted Times Square bomber Faisal Shahzad, who is a naturalized U.S. citizen. But human rights groups say that such a law would be unconstitutional. FSRN's Matt Pearson reports.
Lieberman says his Terrorist Expatriation Act won't affect the prosecution of suspected Times Square bomber Faisal Shahzad. But he says his proposal is a response to that and other terrorist activity involving U.S. citizens.
Shahzad is just the latest in a growing and accelerating line of cases where American citizens have supported or fought for al-Qaeda or affiliated terrorist organizations against the United States.
Lieberman's legislation, co-sponsored by Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown and two U.S. Congress members, authorizes the State Department to revoke U.S. citizenship from nationals accused of aiding foreign terrorist organizations. He says the law would allow the U.S. to prosecute terror suspects outside of civilian courts by revoking their citizenship.
If they lose their citizenship, the administration has the choice, which the administration has exercised in some cases, as you know, to bring them before a military tribunal.
But some say the legislation is an excuse to attack the practice of reading arrested terror suspects their Miranda rights. Some members of Congress, including the hawkish Lieberman, say terror suspects should not be read their rights. On Thursday, Attorney General Eric Holder defended the Judiciary Department's use of Miranda on alleged Times Square bomber Faisal Shahzad. Holder said the use of Miranda helps federal courts successfully prosecute terrorists.
It is not conferring a right on somebody or giving them, treating them in a special way. It is allowing us to make sure that statements that they give to us are going to be admissible in court.
Holder also defended the use of the federal court system to prosecute terror suspects. Some, like Lieberman, say those suspects should be tried in military courts.
If you were to take from us the ability to use the federal courts, you will weaken our ability to win this war. You will weaken the strength of this nation.
In fact, studies by the Department of Justice show that federal courts have been far more effective than military commissions in convicting terrorists. Since the 9/11 terrorist attacks, federal courts have secured more than 400 convictions compared to military courts, which have convicted only 3 detainees. Still, Lieberman wants alleged terrorists to be tried in military courts.
I believe that anybody apprehended and charged with attempting to commit a terrorist act against the United States is effectively a prisoner of war and should be handled and tried by the military system of justice.
But Lieberman and his co-sponsors denied that their expatriation law is a way to get around Miranda rights in federal courts. They say they are simply updating the existing law, which was created during World War II to apply to any American who enlisted in German or Japanese armies to fight against U.S. troops in Europe or the Pacific. Now it applies to Americans who choose to serve in any foreign national army, with a few exceptions, for instance, the Israeli army. Pennsylvania Democratic Representative Jason Altmaier is one of the co-sponsors of the legislation.
And what we have done is taken a law that has been in existence for 70 years and modernized it.
But some lawyers say the legislation conflicts with the most recent Supreme Court decision on the existing law, Vance v. Terrazas, in 1980. Shane Kadida from the Center for Constitutional Rights says that decision stated that a U.S. national must intend to forfeit his citizenship before the government can take it away. Therefore, if a person commits a terrorist act, that does not necessarily mean they should lose their citizenship. Lieberman's law says they should.
What the court said in that case was that, to say that the act was done voluntarily is not enough, but that instead you need to prove the intent to lose citizenship, not the intent to do the act.
Meanwhile, human rights groups say the law sets a dangerous precedent. Daphne Aviatar of Human Rights First says since 9/11, the U.S. definition of who is an enemy combatant has gotten too broad.
Somebody who, let's say, lets a friend stay in their apartment or lets them use their cell phone and doesn't know what that person is doing with it, and if that person turns out to have been assisting Al-Qaeda in some way, the person who lent them that phone could therefore be considered a suspected terrorist and could suddenly be labeled a war criminal.
Meanwhile, Democrats in the House and Senate have praised law enforcement on the local, state, and federal levels for their cooperation in successfully arresting and prosecuting Shahzad. Attorney General Holder said Thursday that officials were continuing their interrogation of Shahzad and that he remained cooperative. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
The Federal Communications Commission issued a proposal today that would create internet regulations. The FCC calls it a third way, a moderate approach to overseeing a service that has remained unregulated. FSRN's Leon Caldwell reports.
The FCC's proposal stems from the mainstreamization of the internet back in the 1990s. Since then, the internet has remained largely unregulated. But in 2007, Comcast internet subscribers sued Comcast for degrading their internet service. The FCC said Comcast was illegally downgrading a customer's service. Comcast sued and said the FCC had no power to regulate the internet. A U.S. Court of Appeals agreed with Comcast. That brings us to today. FCC Chair Julius Genachowski attempted to respond to the court case. His proposal says the FCC does have power to regulate the internet under the category of telecommunications. Chair Genachowski calls his proposal a middle-of-the-road approach. In a statement, he said it doesn't take an entirely hands-off approach, nor is it heavy-handed, which would chill investment and innovation. Internet regulation is a controversial issue, with internet providers on one side wanting no regulation and public interest groups on the other wanting an open, equally accessible internet through government assurances. Beth McConnell is executive director of the Media and Democracy Fund. She says the proposal is a step in the right direction.
If they move forward and they pursue the public interest aggressively and adopt strong rules at the end of this process, that means the FCC will have the power to protect broadband consumers from unfair practices of big cable and phone companies. That's what we really want to see them do.
But the service providers are less enthused. In a statement, Comcast said it could hurt innovation and investment. Barbara Espin is a former attorney for the FCC and is now with the Progress and Freedom Foundation, a group that supports a free market approach to the internet.
Not everything has to be regulated. Generally, you impose economic regulation when you have a monopoly service provider or you have some other form of market failure, consumer harm. And we just haven't seen that with respect to broadband internet access service.
But public interest groups disagree. They say the Comcast case is an example of market abuse and that the internet could perform much better for consumers. Amalia Deloney is with the Media Action Grassroots Network.
We want people in our communities to not just be consumers, where they're only getting information that that they consume through the internet, but we want them to be knowledge producers, content producers. We want the internet to be this open channel for freedom of information and creativity. And all of that is tied up in this decision around classification.
The FCC's proposal would extend free speech rights to the internet, protect privacy, and ensure access, regardless of geography, disability, and income. There will be a public comment period before this proposal would go through. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Hundreds of thousands of children in the U.S. work in dangerous conditions doing farm work, and U.S. regulations are failing to adequately protect them. That's according to a report released this week by Human Rights Watch. The report finds that child farm workers risk safety and health and often miss out on educational opportunities. Zama Korsun-Neff is the author of the report and deputy director of the Children's Rights Division at Human Rights Watch. Korsun-Neff interviewed 59 children, some who had begun working part-time on farms when they were as young as six.
Kids are talking about neck pain, back pain, pain in their feet, the kind of pain you'd expect from an old person. Kids are also sprayed with pesticides. Some kids told me that they were sprayed directly from an airplane or from a tractor. But a lot of other kids told me that they were working while the fields next to them were sprayed, and the wind blows and blows the pesticides onto them. Pesticides are associated with cancer, with brain damage, with hormonal changes, with reproductive problems. Now, pesticide exposure isn't good for any farm workers, but it's especially bad for children whose bodies are still developing.
In addition to exposure to pesticides, children also face serious injury and heat illness, and girls are especially vulnerable to sexual abuse. According to the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, it is the most dangerous work open to children in the U.S., and they are four times more likely to suffer fatalities than in any other job. Grecia Bali started working on a farm at 10 years old. She's now 17. In an interview provided by Human Rights Watch, she said that constant moving made her struggle in school.
Okay, I catch up with my friends here and everything in school, and I go back to Florida. I don't know what they're doing either. So that's when I made the decision when I was 14, drop out of school to just work, because I was like, I'm not going to do nothing in school. I'm not going to get nothing out of it because of our ways, like traveling back and forth. And so I started working on the fields when I was 14.
Human Rights Watch is calling for stronger laws and better enforcement of regulations. In 2009, Congresswoman Lucille Roybal Allard of California introduced the Children's Act for Responsible Employment. Yet despite 80 co-sponsors and endorsements from the AFL-CIO, the NAACP, United Farm Workers of America, and others, no action has yet been taken. You can find a link to the full report, Fields of Peril, Child Labor in U.S. Agriculture, on our website, fsrn.org.
Hi, I'm Nathan Moore, FSRN's General Administrator. I want to thank you for tuning in, and I want to doubly thank all of you who visited fsrn.org during our recent Deep Roots campaign. Here at FSRN, we're celebrating our 10th anniversary and our deep roots in the communities we report from. Scores of you reached into your pockets and gave generously to FSRN. You watered and nourished FSRN's deep roots, and you helped make our campaign a success. From all of us at FSRN, thank you for supporting independent media. Visit us again online at fsrn.org.
A case challenging the Defense of Marriage Act began today in Boston. A federal judge heard arguments about whether the law, which denies federal recognition of same-sex marriages, is constitutional. Meanwhile, Argentina is a step closer to legalizing same-sex marriage. The South American nation's lower house approved gay marriage on Wednesday, and the bill will now go to the Senate. FSRN's Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
If passed, Argentina will become the first country in Latin America to implement national legislation lifting a ban on same-sex marriage. On Wednesday, gay rights activists celebrated the House of Deputies' decision to approve gay marriage. Five same-sex couples have married following court rulings declaring the ban on gay marriage unconstitutional. Martin Canevado and his partner tied the knot to become Argentina's fourth gay married couple.
I have been happily married to Carlos Alvarez for 20 days, following a court ruling which declared the civil code, which impedes marriage between two people of the same sex, as unconstitutional.
Despite these case-by-case judicial rulings, which could eventually be considered by the Supreme Court, lesbian and gay rights organizations have pushed for a national law that would allow marriage between gay couples. If approved, the law would grant the same basic rights that opposite-sex married couples have, rights that are more comprehensive than those granted under civil unions. President of Argentina's Federation of Lesbians, Gays, Bisexuals, and Trans, Maria Rashid, explains.
We need this law for two fundamental reasons. First, to have all of the rights which marriage guarantees, sharing with your partner a social security plan, being able to leave the person you love a pension, to leave them an inheritance. Even though these rights are an important part of a person's daily life, there's another reason which is even more important, which is access to legal equality. To fight against this discrimination and violence, we need equal legal recognition from the state.
Until now, no Latin American country has formally recognized gay marriages, although Mexico City's legislature has approved them. Same-sex civil unions have been approved in Buenos Aires and other places in Argentina, as well as in Uruguay, Ecuador, Colombia, and in one state of Venezuela. Martin Canevado is president of the NGO 100% Diversity and Rights. He says that the lower house's approval of the same-sex bill sends the message that Argentina, historically conservative nation, has progressed.
The message for gays, lesbians, and trans women and men is for us to be able to live without fear. The parliament sent a message that we should be able to live in freedom and not in the closet. For gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transsexuals not to have that protection is an act of discrimination and violence that we can't allow when we are in the 21st century. This law will level the rights of gay and lesbian families with the rights of heterosexual families. This law would repair decades of institutional discrimination and violence.
Following 12 hours of debate, the lower house voted 126-110 to approve the bill. Vilma Ibarra is a national deputy who wrote the current bill, now on its way to Senate.
That today a homosexual is prohibited from accessing a civil institution such as marriage due to discrimination based on their sexual orientation is part of the struggle for equality. Argentina's taking the forefront in pushing for the fight against discrimination may encourage other countries to make similar laws for equal rights.
The Senate must now approve the bill. Senators allied with the president's party pledged to pass the bill, and the president vowed not to veto the measure if it reaches her desk. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Doran Marina. Mm-hmm.